Good morning, everyone. Some of you know that not too long ago, fall of 2012, I suffered the loss of my sister. She was 2.5 years older than I am. She suffered from cancer for 5 years and went very quickly at the end. And within another few months, my father passed away. And they said that he passed away from kidney disease, but really he passed away from a broken heart. We knew that. So for a long time since then, I've had this idea in mind to talk about this whole process of grieving and mourning and the importance of it for all of us. And everyone has something in their lives. There's no one who is immune to this. This is one thing we know, that this is a universal thing that everyone has to face one day or another. So when this happened, I was very interested in seeing the reaction of everyone to this, family members and friends and everything. And what surprised me more than anything was my own reaction, because I was a mess. I thought of all the people that here I've been living with these Vedantic ideas for how many, over 40 years now, and I've had to talk to so many people who have gone through this mourning process and with great words of wisdom and everything, so that I would be fine, but I was a mess. So I found it to be very interesting and thought that I would share some of these ideas with all of you today. I took the title of this talk, "Thou Oughtest Not to Grieve," from a phrase that's repeated various times in chapter 2 of the Bhagavad Gita. This idea of grief and grieving is one of the major themes that we find in the Gita, because Arjuna is aware that if he takes part in the battle and does what he's supposed to do, that many of his relatives will die in that battle. And we know the whole story, that they were two sets of cousins, and they actually grew up together, so it was very close. They had mutual grandparents, of course, and teachers and gurus and everything. So Arjuna was faced with this great dilemma. In the beginning, he had great bravado. He said, "Yes, let's go and fight in this battle. Take me to the battlefront. Let me see all of the people that I have to do battle with in the ensuing war that will take place." And for some reason, it's very strange, we don't get any good explanation, he should have known ahead of time, right? He knew that who he was fighting, but for some reason, it didn't strike him until he actually saw that it was all of his cousins. And he knew that they had done a lot of mischief, that they stole, you know, their portion of the kingdom and did all sorts of things, put them into exile and everything. But still, he was overcome with what is termed in the Gita, this dalbalyam, this faint-heartedness, this weakness. Hridaya dalbalyam, this weakness of heart. So we find that one of the great themes of this Gita, from a storyline point of view, is that Sri Krishna is now faced with a dilemma. Everything is going smoothly. The battle is arranged and it's supposed to take place any time now. But Arjuna is one of the key players. He has to fight in the battle for the sake of the restoration of dharma, dharma sthapana. This is one of the reasons why Sri Krishna himself was born, because there was this down surge of dharma, this increase of adharma, and this was his role to play in this lila. So he had to play this role. Now, Sri Krishna says later, of course, that everything is done already. But still, one of the main themes is that he has to try to convince him why he should fight in this battle. And part of the convincing it has to do with this idea that his highly respected and beloved kinsmen, some of them weren't so beloved, but some of them were, might end up dying in this battle. Now, Arjuna, when he sees that, he wants to get out of it. And he comes up with all different options. He says it would be better for me to enter into the battle without any weapons. Let me simply go there, let them kill me. That would be better than if I killed them. If I kill them, how will I enjoy the kingdom? Everything will be smeared in blood, he says. Very strong type of statement. Or he says, let me simply give up this whole business. Let me go and just become a wandering mendicant. Maybe he means I'll stop being kshatriya, I'll be a sannyasi. It's not very clear, but... And then he says, let them win the war. It doesn't matter. Let them win the war. Better that than if I have to kill all of these people. So the better part of chapter 2 represents Sri Krishna's rebuttal to all of the arguments that Arjuna has made. Some are more convincing than others. And we have to remember that there's a story here. He'll even say, you know, they'll make fun of you and this and that, appealing to his kshatriya nature and everything. But some of them, of course, are very strong arguments. The main argument is that somehow Arjuna's grief is misplaced. It's based on a false understanding that somehow he's grieving for people who shouldn't be grieved for. And we have this. This is the very beginning of this series of arguments. Sri Krishna begins by tossing a few crumbs to Arjuna. He'll say, you're what you say makes sense. It's not bad. So he says, Ashochyan anvashochastvam pragyavadam shabhashase. So you're speaking pragyavada. You're saying words of wisdom. Where's the wisdom? But then he says, gadasun agadasunscha na anushochanti panditaha. So yes, you've spoken words of wisdom, but, this is a very big but, you were mourning for those who should not be mourned for. Now, this doesn't mean that these Kauravas were really bad guys, and it doesn't matter if they die, no one will care about them anyhow. Because he says those who are truly wise, here he says pandit. So pandita in Sanskrit doesn't mean someone who spouts. We talk about pundits nowadays, but it meant someone who was really wise. So he says, you've spoken words of wisdom, but those who are really wise, they know that they do not grieve either for the living or the dead. So it means all people, not just because the Kauravas were evil, but he says there's no reason to grieve for anyone, because he'll say the real nature of the self is that it never dies. So we see in this one verse three different variations of the same Sanskrit root, shuch. Shuch means to grieve or to mourn. It actually means to burn, to suffer. It comes from, it's a very strong type of word. So it's used three different times here. Ashochyan once, anvashocha another time, and then anushochanti. So it's used three times. This will be the key word that we'll find in this whole chapter. Shuch, we get shoka from that grief. Ashoka, the famous emperor, is the one free from grief. We talked about the two birds. When the lower bird sees the higher bird, it becomes vishoka. It becomes free from grief. One of the great themes of Vedanta is when we have this high realization, we're free from grief somehow. Because we see that this self never dies, never born, and it never dies. So this is the thrust of Sri Krishna's argument that it's only the body that dies. We don't really die. The real self doesn't die. We change bodies the same way we change clothes. If the cloth gets worn out, it gets holes in it and everything, we throw it away. We take a new cloth. So what do we care? It's just the cloth. So it's just the body that goes. And we make this transition from death to a future birth the same way we do from childhood to youth to old age. It's just another stage in life. Then, in verse 25, we get a series of verses with almost the identical ending. And this is the title that we have. This, Na anushochitum arhasi, or Natvam shochitum arhasi, or Nainim shochitum arhasi. You ought not to grieve. So it's a very strong statement. There's no reason for you to grieve. There's nothing. Why would anyone grieve if there's no death, if there's not really death at all? So this is basically what he's saying, that there's no real cause for sadness, that death is ultimately an illusion. Now, before we start attacking Sri Krishna's arguments, because there's something wrong about them, right? Something wrong about them. It may sound a little self-serving. He's just trying to convince him to fight in this battle. It may sound a little dismissive or even a little heartless or a little inhuman. Right? But we have to remember two things. One is that this Leela, he has to convince him. Second thing is he's talking from the point of view of the person who has died. There's no real death. The self continues for that person. He's not really saying that there's no reason for anyone to grieve at the death of someone else. Because we don't grieve for the death of someone, we grieve because of our own loss. There's a huge difference. There's a very big difference there. And this will kind of be the main point that I'm trying to make this morning, that as much as we can say that there's no reason to grieve, because there's no really death, nothing really is happening. The self, this idea of a jiva, we may even say is just an illusion. That isn't God playing the role of each and every one. But this grieving process is very important and very necessary. We know that from a point of view of modern psychology, we know it. And from the point of view of every ancient religion, we know it. There are always many rituals and practices associated with this period of grief, this mourning period, that are extremely helpful and extremely important. So this is the main issue here, that the real issue of grief and mourning has nothing to do with the departed soul. It has to do with us. It has to do with us, that regardless of what we think about death, suppose we think that, well, it was a very good person, this person will go to heaven and have a wonderful life there, or will be merged in God. We should rejoice at such an idea. But still, it's the sense of loss that we have to deal with. We get some comfort, of course, from this idea, oh, they're in a better place. We get some comfort from it, but still, we mourn our own personal loss. There's been a lot of research that has been done with regard to this process of mourning or grieving. And we know one very important fact, that if we don't go through this period, we don't heal. It's a type of healing process that takes place. We need this period. In some traditions, there'll be a whole year. You'll do something for a certain period, and then after that, you're supposed to stop. Or there'll be a 12-day period, we'll have a bhandara. But this idea of mourning, it has to be gone through and it has to end. That's the other thing. There has to be some closure to the whole thing. So we find that in recent times, there's been a lot of research and thought done to this. There was a very great, I guess we would call her, therapist or psychologist or something, by the name of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And she wrote a very important book called On Death and Dying. She wrote it in 1969. I read it many, many years ago. It was a very interesting book. She discovered that when she did work in hospitals, that doctors themselves didn't know how to approach patients and talk to them about death. That somehow was a taboo subject. And she discovered so many interesting things, that people on their deathbed would keep themselves alive in great discomfort or pain or suffering, because they felt that their loved ones weren't ready for them to depart. And when she worked with these people and she told them that, no, sit by the side of your loved one and say, we'll miss you, but it's time for you to go. We don't want to see you suffer like this. And many times they went very quickly after that. We have that ability to cling to life a little bit and to let go a little bit. Of course, it's not entirely in our hands, but to a certain extent. And she noticed so many interesting things, that so many people, they had something that they were looking forward to. Some of the graduation of a child, or Christmas, or Easter, some big holiday or something. And somehow they would make themselves live just that long. And then afterwards, they would let go. And they couldn't easily. So she did a lot of research about this. What she did was she came up with five different categories. And her work works on two levels. One is with the person who is about to die. And the other, and it works equally well, is for the people who have to watch the loved one die. So she came up with these different categories. And the categories are important because we can recognize where we fall there. And if we understand that we're going through this particular stage, we can get over it. And if we know that others also go through it, it's very helpful. So I want to go through a little bit some of these stages. And she makes it clear that there's a logic to it, one after the other, but not everyone goes through all of them. Some will just do one or two. Some will get stuck in one. Some will never progress out of it. Some will go through all of them, but each one has something very important to teach us. Now, she starts out with denial, and this works, again, both ways. Suppose someone is told that you may not have long to live, you have a disease, we don't have any cure for it now. So the first reaction is denial. For the person and also for the loved ones, we see this so many times that we watch other people, especially cancer and things like that, that they never give up hope that there'll be some miraculous cure or something. Sometimes there is, of course, but many times there simply isn't, and great denial that way. One of the best illustrations we have of this denial and a way to get over it is a very beautiful story, perhaps the best known story associated with the Buddha. We've heard this story, all of us, many, many times, but I want to repeat it because I'm not sure that we've really thought through it very deeply, the really deeper significance of it. This is, of course, the story of this Kisa Gotami. She was a young bride. And in India, you know, a young bride, that means that she has to leave her parents' home and go to the home of her husband, and she'll be very lonely and won't know what to do. It's a very difficult period. Then a child was born to her, and in the meantime, her husband died. So this infant that was born was all she had to cling to. It was her whole life. Then infant got a little sick, got some fever, and the next thing she knew, she's holding this dead child. And she's in complete denial. Either she can't believe that the child is dead, or she feels that somehow there's some way to revive the child. So she goes to everyone she can find, and she says, can you tell me, is there some medicine? Is there something that can be done? And everyone sees, and they try to tell her, you know, painful to say, but don't you see your child is dead? What can be done? So finally someone said, go to the Buddha and see if he can do anything. So instantly he understood the whole situation. And he said, yes, my child, I can revive your infant, but you'll have to go and bring me some white mustard seeds. So you can go, it's a little village, there's so many homes here. You can go and knock on a door and see if anyone has any mustard seed that they can give you. You'll bring it to me and I'll make some medicine and I'll cure your child, bring your child back to life. But, he says, it has to be from a home where no one has ever died. Right now, it's not like today when you can buy a new house. These were ancestral things. They lived there for years and years and years and generations. So this is the point where we have to try to imagine this whole thing. And the other thing is, for a mother to lose a child, This is probably the worst scenario that we have. You know, this is the incident that took place with Baburam Maharaj's mother. Baburam became Swami Premananda. His mother, Matangani Devi, was a great devotee of Sri Ramakrishna. And Sri Ramakrishna said to her, give me your child. I want your son. That man, he wanted him to become a monk and to stay with him as his sevak and everything. She was happy, but she said to him, does a mother ever give up a son for nothing? You'll have to give me something in return. He said, yes, what do you want? She said, I want the boon that I will not live so long that I see any of my children die. So he said, yes. And many years later, the Swami Premananda was extremely ill, and they really gave up hope. They thought that he won't survive this illness. And he said, no, my mother is still alive. It's impossible for me to die. And it happened. He recovered and then passed away at a relatively young age, but after his mother had passed away. So now we have to try to picture this young girl. How old will she be? 18, something like that. Going from house to house and asking them, has anyone ever died in this house? First of all, they'll say, yes, oh, we'll get the mustard seed, no problem. Then she says, oh, but wait, has anyone ever died in this house? And then she has to listen to story after story after story. Yes, you know, mother just died, a child died, someone died from snake bite, someone from malaria, someone committed suicide. So hour after hour, see, the whole day from one house to another, going through the whole village, hearing story after story, until she came to that realization that, yes, everyone has to undergo suffering. There's no way to avoid it. And somehow this denial and somehow this pain was lifted from her, to a certain extent at least. And she went back to Buddha and said, he said, have you brought the mustard seed? And she said, no, I've come to take shelter with you. Now I understand why you sent me for all of this. So it's a very, very beautiful story that we have about this Kisa Gotami. The second stage that Kubler-Ross talks about is anger. And really, sometimes people never get over this stage. That there's anger. Usually this is people who have some deep faith that God will look after them. So there's anger, either it's how could it happen to me, or how could it happen to my child, or how could it happen to my loved one, this and that. This anger comes in the face of death. And what did I do to deserve this? And haven't I led a good life? And haven't I prayed every day and did my worship and everything? All of these things, somehow we think that we're saved from any type of problem. So this anger comes there. And after the passing away also, this anger is there sometimes. How is it possible that that happened? How could you let that happen? First, the anger is that we see that we may die or a loved one may die. Then afterwards, it actually happens. So there's anger, as I say, sometimes it's a sign of our great faith in the power of prayer, in this belief that God will look after us, will protect us and everything. And it may be a good thing from one point of view. This is Abhiman attitude that we see, that we fight with God. If it means that we really have that type of faith, then it's a good thing. Now, the problem is that sometimes the anger will mean that, well, I don't care for you anymore and I don't believe you anymore. And when we see that there are devotees that they'll have some tremendous shock and that's it. They'll say, no, I won't go to the temple anymore, I won't do this anymore. And, you know, they really lose their faith that way. For others, it's just a sign of how much they believe in God and how they really feel this closeness and everything. But for them, they have to get over this anger. There has to be some type of acceptance that comes. When I hear people say that, oh, Thakur saved me this time, It's very nice that people have that faith, but I get very nervous. What do they say when Thakur doesn't save them? Because no one is safe. Sooner or later, something will come to everyone. And if we really feel that, yes, Thakur is there, that he'll always save us, then what happens to our faith afterwards? I knew someone who formed this habit. Whenever she would leave her house, she would say, Durga, Durga. And we read this, Durga, 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 Bole, Jeva, Kote, Chole, Jai, Shulo, Hasto, Shulo, Pani, Rakha, Korentai. All right. Whoever leaves the house saying, Durga, Durga, Shiva himself, with a trident in his hand, will protect that person. So one day she left the house and got mugged after saying the Durga Durga. So she said, well, what good is the whole thing? So how to explain these things? We want that faith, but we want to be realistic also. And then what do we do? Are we angry after that? So we have to somehow channel this and somehow put that anger to use. Let the anger towards God increase our faith in God or belief in God. There's a very interesting reaction that Swami Vivekananda had when Goodwin died. Goodwin was an Englishman who was in the United States, of course, met Swamiji there, and traveled with him and took shorthand notes of all of his lectures. It's because of Goodwin that we have all of the complete world of the lectures that Swamiji gave that he took down in shorthand and later wrote out. He went to India with Swamiji, and while he was in India, he went to the South. He got sick and he died. And it was a tremendous shock to Swamiji. Maybe a slight tinge of guilt. And we'll see guilt plays a big part in all of this, because there was a slight falling out, not with Swamiji himself, but with some of the other people in the work and everything. And he was kind of working independently. He took a job as helping with the editing for the Madras Mail or some newspaper, something like that. But anyhow, Swamiji had such a reaction to that, and it was suggested that, oh, this was the will of God, what can we do, this and that. So Swamiji said, as if it would not be one's right and duty to fight such a God and slay him for killing Goodwin. So this was that reaction, little bit of anger there, but this is the anger in a positive sense. So if it means that, of course, we don't know why and how things happen, but if it means that it increases our faith rather than breaks our faith in God, then we can deal with it. But it's a stage, and we have to transcend this, the anger. Now, the Kubla Ross speaks about a third stage. So we find out someone is dying or we're about to die, then bargaining. Then the bargaining comes, give me a few more years, I'll do whatever you say. Again, it shows a belief in God. That some people will even say, I'll donate a big building, I'll do charitable work, you know. And there are people who, when it's the other way around, someone else is dying, they'll really do some type of bargain, take me instead. We know Thakur's story about the young man who said, oh, my family, they love me so much, they would do anything for me. And Thakur says, well, come and I'll show you. And so the guru says, I'll show you. And he gives him a pill. It looks like he's dead. He goes to the home and he says, they say, oh, well, our son died. What to do? He said, I can bring your son back to life, but someone will have to take the same medicine and they'll die. So one by one, they say, well, what's done is done, and the rest of the family is here, and what would they do if I, one by one. But the truth is that there are people who will make that bargain, especially parents. There are many parents, they'd rather die than see a child die. So this is part of that bargaining. This is the third stage. Huh? Then depression. And this is a very strong word. We can say deep sadness, feeling of emptiness. All of these things are very natural. We'll all feel that when we feel that either we've just lost someone or we're about to lose someone. And it's even stronger when it's a very wonderful, beloved person, when a good person. And when the person who is about to experience the loss is also a great soul, we sometimes think these are great souls, they're above all of these things. When Swami Turiyananda was in California, he had a great desire to see Swamiji, who had gone back to India. And this was just the beginning of 1902. And Swami Turiyananda, he went by ship, and while he was on the way, I think it stopped in Rangoon or something, while he was on the way, he got news that Swamiji had died, so that he would reach India, you know, just a week or so too late to see Swamiji again. And his sense of feeling of grief and sadness and emptiness was tremendous. So much so that he never engaged in, he certainly didn't go back to the West again, and he never really engaged in any of the work of the order the way many of the others did. We can say it almost broke him. He never really recovered from that. So great was his attachment. So these great souls, they have a tremendous attachment to other great souls. It's not a bad thing. We want to have that type of attachment to these really great souls that way. But still, we say that with everyone, that this feeling of sadness, this feeling of depression may come. We look at the life of Holy Mother. When Sri Ramakrishna passed away, she felt there's no reason to live anymore. She really did. They had to take her on pilgrimage. She had to have several different visions of Sri Ramakrishna where he assured her, no, I'm still present, I'm still available to you. You can have my vision. She had to have her own disciples, all of this. Ultimately, she had to have Radhu. She had a sister-in-law who became mad and gave birth to a small child. This little girl was completely helpless, no one to look after her. So the Holy Mother saw her and felt that, yes, there's some reason to live, that this connection. She said, who is this? And Sri Ramakrishna came to her, it's a vision or a voice somehow, and said, yeah, this is your yoga maya. This will keep you tied to the world. So even Holy Mother had such sadness. And when all of the different direct disciples, many of them passed away before she did. And it was a terrible blow to her. Swami Yogananda was the first disciple and attendant of hers, and it was a great shock. So each time it was, she would say, another brick has been taken out of the building. Soon the whole thing will fall down completely. Then we get to the last stage, which is the stage of acceptance. And this, of course, is the most important, and not everyone reaches this stage. Some people go through a whole lifetime, especially if it's a very tragic type of death, and especially if there's some guilt involved. Sometimes people never reach the stage of acceptance, but when we understand that really there's no other option, everyone will die one way or another, and that we have to just go on with life. Sooner or later, it'll happen to all of us, some earlier, some later, and we don't know why, whether it's karma, whether it's will of God, whether it's chance, fate. We don't know any of these real answers to these things, but if we understand it's inevitable, then this is a key ingredient. One of the verses that I was talking about with this Anatvam Shochitum Arhasi, it says, Tasmat aparihariyate natvam shochitum arhasi. You shouldn't grieve over that which is inevitable. There's no way to change it. Death is inevitable to everyone. So if there's no way to change it, then you shouldn't really grieve over it, because it's going to happen whether we like it or not. So really we have no choice but to accept it. Either we accept it or we suffer even more and more. Now, one of the most helpful ways of understanding this grief and almost every other human emotion is to look at the way these great souls handle these things. Who are role models? Who are our role models? Sri Ramakrishna, Holy Mother, Swamiji, all of the direct disciples, we may think that they're way above us, that we have nothing to learn from them. But it's the opposite. They lived for that reason. That was the whole point of Sri Ramakrishna's whole life, that he wanted us to mold ourselves according to his life. That's why he came. And he said that whenever the Lord himself comes in human form, this avatar, even when the Lord comes in human form, that he behaves exactly like a human being. He has a human body, he has a human heart, has human emotions and everything. This is that Pancha Bhutir Fande, Brahma Pare Kande. He used to say that even Brahman, when it falls into the snares of the five elements, that means this human body, even Brahman weeps. And he would say how Rama wept for Sita and everything. So it's not just their spiritual greatness, but their humanness that attracts us so much. So it's very helpful to look at different ways that they reacted to this sense of loss and this sense of grief. So I want to just give a couple examples. Both ways. One is how they counseled people who were going through grief, and the other is how they experienced it themselves. We've already seen in the life of Holy Mother that she went through these various stages of grief at the death of Sri Ramakrishna and some of her own disciples. She even went through this bargaining stage, right? When Thakur was on his deathbed with the cancer, she went to Tarakeshwara. And she bargained. She said, I'm going to lie here, and I'm going to fast, and then you'll cure him. You'll have to do it. Thakur also bargained. You remember, when Keshav was dying, yeah, he said to the Divine Mother, yeah, if you save him, then we'll offer you some the Dabjini, this green coconut water. Yeah, if... He didn't offer it first and say, now please do it. He withheld it. So there's also a type of bargaining there. So Holy Mother, she tried that. Ultimately, she reached that acceptance because she knew, and Thakur also knew, she said, see, nothing happened, huh? What is to be will be. But there's another very touching story. I don't remember all the details. I tried to find it. I couldn't find it. All the details. I think there was a young woman who had lost a child, if I remember correctly, and came to Holy Mother in tremendous grief. And there were many other people around, other women were there, and they all expected Holy Mother to start telling her, oh, my child, what can you do? The Lord has taken your baby, and you pray, and all to give these nice words of comfort. But she didn't say anything. And people saw, they could see that just she started to feel that same sadness and she started weeping. And very silently, she and this other woman just wept together as if it had been her own child. And it went a great way to relieving the grief of that woman. Now, when we come to the case of Sri Ramakrishna, he had his own unique way of doing things. We know that. There are many times when he had to deal with this question. After all, M had lost a child and others. But there's one particularly interesting case. Adhar Sen was a great devotee of Sri Ramakrishna. And he had a friend who had recently lost his son and was in a terrible state of grief and sadness. So he thought, let me take him to Sri Ramakrishna and see if his sadness can be lifted somehow. Now, somehow on this occasion, that Sri Ramakrishna got this very militant type of attitude. So it says, this is from the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. By this time, Sri Ramakrishna had become better acquainted with Adhar, who related the grief of his friends, the cause of his friend's grief. The master sang as if to himself. So he sang this beautiful Bengali song. To arms, O man. Death storms your house in battle array. Bearing the quiver of knowledge, mount the chariot of devotion. Bend the bow of your tongue with the bowstring of love, and aim at him the shaft of Mother Kali's holy name. Here is a ruse for the fray. You need no chariot or charioteer. Fight your foe from the Ganges' bank, and he is easily slain. Then Sri Ramakrishna said to him, What can you do? Be ready for death. Death has entered the house. You must fight him with the weapon of God's holy name. God alone is the doer. I say, O Lord, I do as thou doest through me. I speak as thou speakest through me. I am the machine, and thou art the operator. I am the house, and thou art the indweller. I am the engine, and thou art the engineer. Give your power of attorney to God. One doesn't come to grief through letting a good man assume one's responsibility. Let his will be done. Then he added, But isn't your grief for your son only natural? The son is one's own self reborn. Lakshmana ran to Ravana when the latter fell dead on the battlefield. Looking at Ravana's body, he found that every one of his bones was full of holes. Thereupon he said to Rama, O Rama, glory be to your arrows. There is no spot in Ravana's body that they have not pierced. Brother, replied Rama, the holes you see in his bones are not from my arrows. Grief for his sons has pierced them through and through. These holes are the marks of his grief. It has penetrated to his very bones. The most striking example we have is Sri Ramakrishna's own reaction to the death of a very beloved nephew of his, Akshay. Now, to understand why he reacted the way he did, we have to know a little bit about the history of this Akshay. I mentioned it last night, those who were in class there, that he was the son of Sri Ramakrishna's eldest brother, Ram Kumar and his wife, and the wife died in childbirth. Ram Kumar had some special powers. He could sometimes see things that would take place in the future. He had a premonition, a very strong premonition, that this child would not live long. And he was so distraught at the death of his wife, he didn't want that same attachment to take place again. So he never played with the baby, he never held the baby, anything like that. Now, this was before Sri Ramakrishna had gone to Dakshineswar, so he was still living in Kumarpukur. He must have been about 12 when this baby was born, and he didn't go to Dakshineswar for another 4 years. So for 4 years, he was the one who played with this baby. He was like a young daddy to this baby. So you can imagine at that age, in that village setting like that, what type of attachment grew there. So he loved this young boy very, very dearly. And then he went to Dakshineswar, more or less forgot about everything. He got lost in the spiritual sadhana and everything. But when Akshay became 17, then he was called to Dakshineswar to become priest of the Radha Govinda temple. So Sri Ramakrishna saw him. Of course, he saw him in intervals when he went back, but after some time, and he had grown up into be a very, they said, a very handsome young man, and a very wonderful, very pure-souled young man. So Thakur was thrilled to have him back again. You can imagine, after playing with him as a little baby, then he gets him back there, living in the same temple compound and everything. Then marriage was arranged for this Akshay, and Sri Ramakrishna had a very bad feeling. And he remembered, of course, Ram Kumar's statement. He had a bad feeling that this marriage is a bad thing for him, that somehow he won't live. And it actually happened. He came down with fever. They did whatever they could to try to nurse him, but he died. Now, Sri Ramakrishna's reaction is so interesting because it shows us both sides. It shows us that side where, what is death? Just the body. The soul doesn't die. There's nothing to mourn about. And then the other side, this sense of loss. Sri Ramakrishna related all of this to, we know it from his own words, to the devotees. This is again from the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna. Akshay died before my very eyes. but it did not affect me in the least. I stood by and watched a man die. It was like a sword being drawn from its scabbard. I enjoyed the scene. I enjoyed the scene. I enjoyed the scene and laughed and sang and danced over it. They removed the body and cremated it. But the next day, as I stood there, pointing to the southeast veranda of his room, I felt a racking pain for the loss of Akshay, as if someone were squeezing my heart like a wet towel. I wondered at it and thought that the mother was teaching me a lesson. I was not much concerned even with my own body, much less with a relative. But if such was my pain at the loss of a nephew, how much more must be the grief of the householders at the loss of their near and dear ones? So this is the tremendous lesson that we learn from Sri Ramakrishna's experience. From this highest point of view, it's true. There's nothing to mourn for. That this body is just a temporary covering. It's just like clothes that we're wearing. There's nothing to mourn for from this Vedantic highest point of view, that the self is not born, it doesn't die, all of this. But what good does it do? The highest Vedantic knowledge gets trumped, completely trumped by the soft emotions of the heart. And that this is what we have to deal with. So to me, it's helpful just to see that even these great souls have to go through this all these different processes, these different stages of mourning. So it's very helpful for us at least to let us know that it's okay, that these are human reactions and that we have to do it, that these are very necessary things so that we can go on with the rest of our lives. So this was my attempt to try to explain some of these deep emotions that surprise us sometimes. We think we're in better control of ourselves, but we get surprised sometimes. We realize when we lose someone how deep our attachment can be that way. So I didn't realize when I scheduled this talk that it was Memorial Day weekend. But this is a time, right, when we remember those who passed away in service of the country and for other things. So. Asado ma satgamaya, tamaso ma jyotirgamaya, mrityor ma maritam gamaya, abhiravir maithi, rudrayate dakshanam mukham, tenamam pahinityam. Om shanti 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 hari om tatsat. Lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness to light. Lead us from death to immortality. Light us through and through, O Lord, and protect us evermore with thy compassionate face. Om, peace, peace, peace be unto all.